Vyayantum Amangani Vak Pranas Chakshushrotramato Balindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakaranam Astu Anirakaranam E Astu Tadatmani Nirate Yagupanishat Sudharmaste Mai Santu Te Mai Santu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
start from verse 7. Okay, after me. Upanishadam bho bruhi.
Upanishadam bho bruhi.
Yes, but Upanishadam bho bruhi.
Upanishadam bho bruhi.
Ityuktate Upanishad Brahmi Vabhate Upanishadam Abhrumeti
Upanishadam Abhrumeti
Tasyaitapodamakarmeti Pratishtha Vedaha Sarvangani Satyam Ayatanam Break the Sandhi. Tasyai Tapaha Damaha
Karma iti.
Pratishtha.
Vedaha.
Sarvangani.
Satyam.
Ayatanam. In the previous verse 7, when the student asks the teacher, "O teacher, please teach me the Upanishad," and now taking the word as Shankara does the Upanishad for that secret, "Please teach me the secret." And then the teacher says, Te Upanishad Brahmi Vava. It goes like this: Upanishadam bho. I'm just doing the so that you can see the sentence. I just got confused reading. Upanishadam bho bruhi iti. Bho, O teacher, may you teach me the Upanishad, that which is that secret. May you teach me the Upanishad, that great secret. Uktate Upanishad. The Upanishad. Upta has been told to you. That secret has been told to you. Then he says, Brahmi Vava Te Upanishadam Abhruma. I taught you the Upanishad, Brahmi, which has as its subject matter Brahman. Okay. That's the end of the verse. But when he says, I taught you that great secret, which I've taught you that Upanishad, which has as its subject matter, or that rahasya, that secret, which has as its subject matter, Brahman, then there remains open in the mind of the student, as from the Bhashya and from Swamiji, is there another secret? Mm. Is there something else I need to know? And that opens for the next, really, the next verse is the whole necessity for preparing the mind. And so we actually have what we've talked about before. We have, there are like two sadhanas. The sadhana for gaining the actual gain of jnanam, so it can be called the jnanasya sadhana, the sadhana for knowledge. It's also called upaya nishta, where my focus and my commitment is on that which is to be gained, which is moksha, which is the knowledge of Brahman. That's called upaya nishta. And that upaya nishta is through shravana, primarily. Shravana means exposing myself to the pramana, to the teaching methodology. And that shravana is supported by manana and nididhyasana. Because first you have to have the shravana before you can do any logical analysis. You can't, from the standpoint of the Vedanta, Brahman is not something that the Atma is Brahman. It's not something that any of your means of knowledge can take you to that. And so it's the Upanishad that is really the pramana that's allowing you to see that. But then as you really gain that knowledge that is given by the pramana, by the Upanishad, manana will come in. And manana is where the mind is really analyzing that knowledge and coming up with certain types of doubts. The types of doubts that we're talking about with manana would be, couldn't it be like this? The Upanishad says it's like this, because with manana you already have some clarity around the vision itself, but your mind needs to negate any other possibilities. So couldn't it be like this? Or how do I know that you say it's like this? How do I know that what the Sankhya say is not right? How do I know that? Because they say something totally different. How do I know that what the Bauddha says, you know, is not right? Or why can't all three of them be right? This is all manana. This is where the mind really has to engage in this vision. But manana supports and depends upon the shravana. So primary is shravana. And nididhyasana also requires shravana, because you need to be contemplating on something that's already been recognized at the time of teaching. So the upaya nishta is in what we call jnanasya sadhana, the sadhana for the knowledge itself, you know. That is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. We have also what's called jnanaya sadhana, the means for that knowledge, means the means for being able to gain that knowledge. That's called the upaya nishta. And that has to, as we normally teach that really has to do with two variables, two things. Chitta naischalya. Naischalya means a steady, stable mind. It's also called chitta aikagrata. Aikagrata, agra means a point, like if you have a leaf of grass, it'll come into a tip. So an agra is a tip. So if you say chitta aikagrata, it means the mind is single pointed. So agrata we use is single pointed. So a mind that is single pointed, or you can also say naischalya, a mind that is not moving about, is a mind that can just be present for this teaching, because the teaching is coming through words, and the mind has to be open and receptive to be able to receive that teaching. So the upaya nishta has to do with developing or growing into the type of mind that is necessary to be able to not only gain this knowledge, but also to hold it. Swamiji used to use the example of, in India, people used to go to the, there would always be somebody there who kept a fire going at all times. And so if you lost your fire, you would go to the firekeeper and you would get fire, some coals, to be able to bring back to your place, where then you would keep tending the coals so that you didn't lose your fire. And so he likens the person going to, from his home, to get the fire, to get the coals, you know, to be able to then keep nurturing them so that fire would always be taking place. And he goes with like some, like a paper bag. So he goes to get the coals of the paper bag. And so they put the coals in the paper bag, and as he walks away, the coals just kind of drop through the paper bag. Yeah. So actually, say, your mind is like a paper bag. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of initially a little on the, like a paper bag. Now, I used to remember I would always say, you know, that I would get this knowledge and it would be so clear and so wonderful until I took a few steps out the door, and then, you know, the knowledge would just flop through the paper bag. Mm-hmm. So that's one example that is actually used. The mind is not ready yet to be able to really make use of, to hold, to abide in this knowledge. It's not, doesn't have the maturity yet. It doesn't have two things. It can be free of it. It doesn't quite have the clarity yet, but also it doesn't have the maturity. And so the other example, just to make sure that you have the paper bag example in this other one, they also use the example of, you know, tules in a lake. So there's, it's like a, you know, a swamp with all the tules coming up. So you can't even see the water at all because all of this grass, this high grass has grown, you know, from the bottom of the lake up. And so in order to see the water, you have to really go in and pull the tules apart. And there's the water. You wouldn't even know otherwise because they're high and the water's down here. So you pull it apart and there's the water. But now, if you take your hands back, you know, it closes over. Yeah. So you have to pull it apart again. That's a good for nididhyasana. I see. Oh, where did it go? Where did it go? My mind's not ready yet to hold it. It doesn't have the maturity. And so that maturity is something, is the second rahasya. And one of the greatest secrets about gaining the kind of the antakarana shuddhi, and we talk so in such depth in the Bhagavad Gita when we're talking about raga dveshas and the neutralization of your likes and dislikes and this kind of thing. The thing is, for this antakarana shuddhi, it really involves, as we'll see now in this verse, it involves, according to this verse, the list that they're giving, is karma. Let me get the right order of it. Tapa, dhamma, karma. Tapas is austerities, we call austerities. But the thing is, and this is going to be true for all of them, tapas is religious austerities. They are austerities or disciplines, we can say, spiritual religious disciplines. And why we say spiritual religious disciplines is because they are meant to help me gain the antakarana naischalya, that steadiness of mind, also called samadhanam, where my mind can abide. They're meant for that. They're meant for freeing myself from raga dveshas, from the likes and dislikes, turning those likes and just those binding likes and dislikes into non-binding likes and dislikes. They are disciplines that I can use in the ikagrita, like for instance meditating in India. What they'll often do is do upasana, where you're actually holding an image like of your ishtadevata in your mind. You hold it steadily in your mind for as long as you can, you know, until actually what you want, and this is also in the yoga shastras, is for that image, which I'm just saying, it could be many different images, but image of your devata, until the subject-object relationship kind of merge. And the only thing that is there is the devata, because the concentration is so strong, you know, that the devata becomes just the primary what is there in your mind. So your mind becomes absorbed by the devata or by anything else that you might be focusing on. So it's learning how to keep your practicing, to keep, give steadiness to your mind. Sometimes students have said, you know, my mind moves so fast. It moves so fast, I don't know what I can even, I don't even know what to do about it. When I'm meditating, my mind is just going. I've heard that several times. It's a particular type of mind. And so that mind, we need it to slow down for a moment, you know. Nothing wrong with the mind, you know, the mind can have a lot of energy, it can thinking of all kinds of things, and you can actually make use of that mind. That can be fine. But until it becomes mithya, and you become its ever-present adhishtana, we have to do certain exercises and things to teach the mind how to train the mind to be able to also be quiet. So you have a choice. Yeah, the mind can be quiet when you want it to be quiet. So these are whole varieties of what we call tapas or austerities that bring about a certain discipline. They bring about a certain discipline to the mind, you know. And you're going to utilize those austerities or the different things that avail themselves to you for areas in terms of your life and your mind where you feel out of control, simply. You feel very out of control. Some people are out of control around their food or around chocolate or around something like that, you know. And so they'll often, and I know especially this is very common in India, they will fast one day a week. That's so common. That's not an easy thing to do. It's a real tapas. It's a discipline. But to do that gives you some control over your eating foods that are not good for you. Another tapas is maunam. Maunam is really good for a person who, if you find that you want to have some control over the things that you talk about, you know. You want to have control over gossip, and you find yourself falling into gossip, you know, because it's actually easy to fall into gossip. There's something pleasurable about gossip also. It's like two of you are together talking about surreptitiously, you know, secretly, this other person or whatever. There's something kind of weird about it, but anyway, it's not a good thing, and we all know it's not a good thing, and it brings a lot of stress into the mind. So how to get control over what you talk about? You think maunam. Do maunam for one or two days a week. Some people are maunam like every Wednesday or every Monday or every Sunday. These are austerities. They're tapas. But it's not like practicing. I'm going to practice tennis 8 hours a day so I can become a tennis champion. That's different. That's a different type of tapas. When we use the word tapas, we're not talking about a sport or something in order to have material gain. We're talking about something that can be very helpful to me in terms of my antakarana shuddhi, that mind that has enough shanti and samadhanam, means enough presence to gain this knowledge, you know. Or that's the naischalya, these type of exercises, you know, being able to keep my mind in one place. And then all of the type of work we do is also can be considered a tapas. It's like the inner child work. Inner child work and being with my pains and coming into relationship with those little ones inside on a daily basis, you know. Because once you start that, you can't abandon them. And so there's got to be an inner commitment there. And you do it so that those sequestered parts in the unconscious can be freed. So that they can be freed, so that they can join back into your conscious mind, which is where they belong. And also then you become freed from these projections and reactions that are continually being triggered. So we learn, it's really a tapas, it's a discipline. Tapas isn't something negative, it's something that I can do in order to bring about the relative freedom, you know, that relative freedom. Dhamma. Dhamma is the next one. Dhamma we usually talk about, and Swamiji talks about this a little differently. He expands on it in a way I haven't really seen him do before, except in the Upanishad, I mean, in the commentary, Dhamma is just the regular control, the control of acting out your thoughts. Remember? Shama, so Dhamma will always kind of include Shama. This is Shama, Dhamma, Upadati, Titiksha, Shraddha, Samadhanam. It's called the Samadhi Shatka, that group of six that are part of the Sadhana Chatushtya, the fourfold sadhanas for Antakarana Shuddhi, for the mind that the mind needs in order to regain this knowledge. Do you remember that? Sadhana Chatushtya Viveka Vairagya Vishamadi Shatka and Mumukshutvam. So these, we have to know these things. So Shama and Dhamma are the first two of this group of six qualities of your mind. Shama is the ability to have control over your thoughts, which would mean in our practice, say a thought comes up, some sort of painful thought or irritated or angry thought or gossipy thought, or I have the ability to let it go. If it's a thought that I don't want to take me away with it, I have the capacity to let it go. So that's a wonderful quality to develop. Because what normally will happen is thoughts will be just flowing through, and then one will catch you. And then you can't let it go. It's already caught you. And so it takes some time, but to gain that kind of space and freedom to allow these thoughts to go that are not useful for you or for anybody else. In fact, they just bring pain. They bring pain and agitation and suffering, basically. So those thoughts, as they rise up, your mind can say, mind knows sometimes, we're not going there. Yes, just toodle along, toodle along. Yeah, you have the freedom to do that. It's a wonderful freedom. But when you can't do it, this is normally how we teach Dhamma, when you can't do that and you're stuck in somebody's irritating you and you're feeling really angry, and there's a pressure, somebody will call this pressure, I like that word, it creates a pressure inside that wants you to strike out, not necessarily physically, that would be a lot of pressure, but at least verbally or bad vibing, that's also a striking out to bad vibe somebody. It's almost like a physical assault. It's just it's a vibratory assault. It's bad vibing and shame, making you feel like better get out of here now. And so those type of acting, those are forms of, I call them acting out, you know. And really, when we have some sort of emotion or feeling that we've gotten stuck with, we learn how not to act that out at all, but rather to go in and do the work that we have to do. The inner child work, the relational work. What is this really about? Why am I so, what difference does it really make? Why am I getting irritated with this person? What is that about? What does it have to do with me? What is my problem inside that's getting triggered by that? So I do that work so that the other people don't have to experience. That's only one reason, though. And in fact, the maybe even more primary reason is I start to do that inner work so I can release myself from that inner trauma or that inner pain so that it doesn't have to project out on the world. And so that inner work is very essential for this Dhamma. Right? Dhamma means that I'm able to not spew out my anger or frustration or irritation. I don't have a need to spew or to project it because I know that there's something going on inside of me and that's where the problem needs to be solved. And so that's a certain capacity that helps you to maintain what we call the shanti in the mind. Now what Swamiji says about this Dhamma, probably in addition to what I'm teaching you now, because that's how he usually talks about it, is the ability to not do useless things. don't waste your time doing useless things, you know. But the thing is meaningless. A lot of things are meaningless, you know. Especially all of our irritations and gossip and doing things that are hurtful to people. There's nothing that anyone gets out of that. Just think about it. It's important to think about that. Does anyone, including you, benefit from these things? You have to say no. Not at all, actually. In fact, everyone, including you, are hurt by it. So it's just a total useless, you know, negative undertaking. So with Dhamma, I am able to not get involved in these useless things. Let the things that I do be helpful. Let them be meaningful. Be helpful to me. Be helpful to you. Be helpful to the Sangha. Be helpful to our animals. Just be meaningful in some way. And the ones that aren't, then let me have the ability to hold that in. So Shum and Dhamma, they're both really, in a sense, spiritual pursuits. They're spiritual pursuit. Because what I'm getting out of it is really a shanti. I'm getting a mind that is available for this knowledge. Not only available for the knowledge, to receive the knowledge, but also to hold the knowledge. And the third one, he says, is karma. So when Swamiji is talking about the karma, he's talking about what we call the nityanamittika karmas. He's using this as a kind of a taking off point. In India, everyone has certain very defined duties, daily duties. Those are the nitya karmas. Your daily duty, often, one of the daily duties is to do a puja. Every morning you do a puja, And for some, they do the puja, then they do a japa to their Ishta Devata. And they have a whole ritual that they go through in invoking their relationship with Bhagavan, and also giving that love and giving that gratitude. And making, just if you think about the doing the puja, I love the way that we do the puja, or you all do the puja here. I know that with Swamiji, how he does that puja is so wonderful. Because you're invoking your relationship with Ishwara, you're bringing Ishwara into your life in a very beautiful way. There's a total presence that we have when we're doing the puja. There's a total presence toward the puja, toward the chants that are so beautiful, and toward all the offerings that are so beautiful. Just in that morning puja, you're invoking Bhagawan's presence, and your life becomes related to Bhagawan in every morning. And so there are many types. One puja is actually a nitya karma. There's certain prayers and things in the Agnihotra, it used to be, prayers that are enjoined on you to do every day. But why do we do it? Well, we do it because it brings me into relationship with Ishwara, with Bhagawan. And that's important. Because this knowledge is not that I am Brahman, it's that I am Ishwara. And in terms of having antakarana shuddhi, or being able to really be free in this world, you must recognize Ishwara. Without that, this world is some concrete entity in your little pocket of consciousness walking around in this inert world. And then that way there is no Ishwara, there's no one that you belong to. I mean literally belong to, part and parcel. Like all my cells in the body, they belong to me. They belong to my body. My body has all of the laws and gives everything it needs to the body and all of the cells in the body to take care of them, And when there's some trouble, it will do everything it possibly can. You really think about it. It's a good analogy for Ishwara. If there's something wrong with the body, so many parts will just come racing to it to try to save it, to try to help it, to try to heal the wound. Right? It's just what's natural. And so the body, if you think of your body as a conscious being made of like an infinite number of parts, and how the whole thing is working together and trying to support each other, that's a well-functioning body, and trying to heal when there's a problem. It's trying to heal the problem. If there's a wound, it's trying to heal the wound. So, if there's any type of ailment. In fact, one thing we find out, this is just a little aside, one thing we find out is the body has its own ways of healing. And a lot of times we don't like the ways that it has for healing, and so we do something to stop that process. Like, for instance, fevers. Fevers are actually very important. Fevers burn away the viruses are the bacteria that are causing the problem. But we don't like to have the fever because we feel sick when we have a fever, so we get rid of the curative factor. But that's why it's really interesting to start going back into some of the kind of the ancient ways of healing. Another one, another one that I think is so beautiful that is in Ayurveda is complete rest. I did this once with Kristen, my niece, and I did it once for a particular reason in India at the Ayurvedic Institute in Coimbatore. I stayed there for 6 weeks. It was 6 weeks of complete rest. They didn't want you to walk around much. They didn't want you to watch any TV, use your computer, or even read books. So I broke the rules a little bit. I had to at least read my books. But what they wanted was extreme rest. And then they cooked very, very, very mild Ayurvedic, an Ayurvedic diet. And then another thing they did was every single day there was an hour of a total body massage, which was using oil, different medicinal oils that they have in the Ayurveda. But it's not just the oils, because they were medicinal oils, and so everybody would get different oils and also different things different things, medicines to take. They're all herbal medicines, but the tremendous relaxation of having that whole body massage, and sometimes there would be like six women, and each was taking a part, and for a whole hour, just rubbing these oils into the body. It's amazing. And then they give you a bath and they wash your hair because you're totally full of oil. And then you just go and then you lie down for another several hours. Total rest and touch. It's amazing. It's just an amazing thing. So these are all these curative things that we learn to do and the curative things that the body does. We have curative things also that the mind, that we do for the mind, or the mind does for itself, But we don't usually rest the mind. So for example, this is the story of the Buddha when he had his disciple go to get him a cup of water. And when the disciple got there, the water was all muddy. The chariot had gone through. The edge of the chariot had gone through the water and made it all muddy. So he came back and he didn't know what to do. It's not drinkable. The Buddha said, just wait a while, go back. He went back in an hour. It looked a little better, but not good. Came back. So you go back in a little while. He went back after two or three times. And then when he got back, everything was absolutely fine. The water was fine. The problem had sunk to the bottom. There was no problem. The water was completely clear. That's an important story. That's a very important story. What that means is you can try in meditation. It's a good meditation. To just relax. Give your mind space. It's got a big problem. It's all agitated. It's feeling hurt and all of this. Just relax and accept it. Welcome it and just sit there until it settles down, and it will settle down. Sometimes it takes 15 or 20 minutes or a half an hour, depending on what it is. But the point is just to see the natural healing capacity of the body and the mind, how it heals itself. It's such something so beautiful, and when you think about it, it's so natural. So we need to be able to learn these things and to practice them, and they bring the body and mind into a much more, balanced position. Now, get back to the karmas. The karmas for us, because every one that is held within the Vedic cultures will do these, Vedic culture will do these nitya and naimittika karmas. The nitya karmas are the daily karmas and the daily rituals that we do, and some other things, but basically the daily rituals that we do that invokes our relationship with Ishwara. It's very much for just a samsari, somebody who's held by the Vedic culture. There is a subject-object relationship. I'm the jiva. I'm doing a ritual to Bhagavan, And that's the extent of it. I do it because it's my duty. I do it for Bhagavan's grace. I do it for the pleasure of Bhagavan. I do it for Bhagavan's blessings, this type of thing. But every day I do it. And then there's naimittika karmas. There's certain times in the year where other pujas are enjoined. And so at that time of the year, I do those pujas. It always has to do with my relationship with Ishwara. Vedanta. They would say for Vedanta and within the, held within the Vedic culture, and for many, many of us, those pujas, we continue to do those pujas. Once we are a mumukshus and gaining knowledge, we continue to do those pujas. but not so that I can get punya or better next birth or just Bhagawan's punya. I do it for antakarna shuddhi. I do it for Bhagawan's blessings to gain a mind that is free of obstructions and to be able to gain this teaching, to gain moksha. That's why I do these pujas, so that any obstruction of the three shantis, you know, may my body, mind, and sense organs be strong and available for this knowledge. May the universe protect me. May the volcano, you know, stay away from the ashram so that I can continue to learn all of this type of thing. And may the devas bless me. May I get no snake bites and this type of thing. So all these three shantis we pray for, we do pujas to, all of that for moksha, for antakarna shuddhi, that allow and also the grace to gain this knowledge. That's the purpose for the puja, one of the purposes. But from this standpoint, in this verse, and just for understanding karma yoga and all of this, the main reason is my developing my relationship with Ishwara. That relationship, the relationship between the jiva and Ishwara, where with knowledge, more and more, you recognize that there is only Ishwara. And this body, like a cell in my body, this body is Ishwara and is taken care of by Ishwara. And so day to day, let me do what there is to be done that's unfolding before me, and tomorrow we'll do the same, and tomorrow we'll do the same. And that way my prarabdha karma will just go along smoothly, and I'll be responding to it like an Ishwara Arpana Buddhi every single day, every single moment. I am responding to Ishwara. This body, mind, sense organs is Ishwara. The self is Ishwara. This is the prarabdha karma. This is Ishwara. And so I allow Ishwara to unfold, and I participate in that unfoldment. So that, what is happening for me to do that, that requires a lot of trust. It requires a lot of knowledge. You know, I have to get over this idea that this is an inert creation, you know, and I have to figure out, you know, how I'm going to survive. And I spend, a lot of people spend a lot of time worrying about that. How am I going to survive? How am I going to get enough money? Am I going to be able to really accomplish my dreams and do what needs to be done and what I want to do? You know, that kartritvam is pretty well rooted because of self-ignorance. And so it's really that tending my relationship to Ishwara in the light of my knowledge, in the light of my knowledge and my mumukshutvam, right, that starts to release, to thin out this ego. The ego that feels that it's up to me to carve out my life out of this inert creation, you know. I've got to carve out my way. The universe, an inert universe, is not really going to help you, right? But this isn't an inert universe. This universe is Bhagawan. This universe is Ishwara, and it is not somebody else. Because the very adhishtana of the whole creation is your adhishtana. The conscious being, the ear of the ear, the eye of the eye, the mind of the mind, the satchit conscious being that is me, is the very me that is Ishwara. I mean that literally. When you say, this me, the self that I am, this sense of me, of myself, from the standpoint of Ishwara, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. This me, very personal me, doesn't belong to this body, mind, sense organs. It belongs to the self. When the body, mind, sense organs are here, it reflects and is so manifest that me. But the me belongs to the self, not to the body, mind, sense organs. And so the me that is, I'm so attached to as me in the form of this body, is the very me that is Ishwara. It's not any different. And so it's not that this creation is somebody else or unknown to me. And so it's just that this small body is part and parcel of my big body. Right? This small manifestation that is part of Ishwara is part of the infinite manifestation, which has the same self as its adhishtana. And so that's what we call the karma. So he says here, He says, Tasya is tasyaha, tapaha, dhammaha, karma, iti pratishta. He says, the Upanishad says that these three, and then with the iti that follows karma iti, it means these three and many others also for the evam. For instance, these three, which are very important ones, the shama dhamma, the tapas, and the karma, means the karma yoga, or the ritual, tending my relationship with Ishwara. These are the pratishta. Pratishta means the basis. And Shankara says, these are the feet. These are the feet. These feet, as though feet, are the ones that hold up the jnanam, the knowledge, the self-knowledge. I have to have a mind, you know, that isn't a paper bag. My mind has to be something that can hold this knowledge. So what makes my mind strong to be able to hold this knowledge? He just gives three. The shama dhamma, and then the tapas, and then that karma yoga, that puja. In fact, with karma yoga, the whole thing is Ishwara Arpana Bhuti. I treat the whole universe as a puja to Bhagawan, because the whole universe is Bhagawan. So the karma yoga buddhi is called Ishwara Arpana Bhuti. I see the whole thing as a puja. And that brings me into relationship with Bhagawan. And then, that's the pratishta. Those are the legs that this knowledge, the Upanishad, the knowledge of the Upanishad stands on. And then it says, and the Vedas, those are the feet, according to Shankara, as Shankara interprets it. Those are the feet. And the Vedas, the four Vedas, are all the angas, are all the limbs. And the head, starting with the head. And then the head is the Vedanta. The Vedanta is the last portion of the Vedas, which tells the reality of the, which reveals the reality of the whole thing. And then all of the other Vedas and the Vedangas are those texts and whatnot, that Shastras that support the Vedas, like Jyotish is a Vedanga. And also the being able to chanting Chandasam is a Vedanga. All of the things that you need to know to support the Vedas, even the Vyakarana grammar, Sanskrit grammar, is a Vedanga. So all of these things become the limbs. They're all the limbs. And then it says at the end, Satyam Ayatanam. And then the abode, the one that is holding this one from head to toe, the head being the Vedanta and all of the limbs being the Vedas, you know. It's the pratishta, the feet that the whole thing stands on, are this really this karma yoga buddhi in your tapas, what you do for antakarana shuddhi. And the head is the vision itself. And then where does it live? It lives in satyam. Satyam has two meanings. Mm-hmm. One meaning for satyam is that your speech, that you speak the truth, that you don't ever have any deceit. You always tell what is truth. There's a definition of satyam. It's called vaktapas. What you should talk about. You should only say certain things. Your speech, your vak, this is the tapas. Your speech should always be satyam. Satyam is the most exalted of all of the values. To speak the truth. It's the most exalted. It comes in every Upanishad. It's held as the foundation of really antakarana shuddhi. To always tell the truth. But what you say should be satyam, but it should also be hitam. It should be beneficial, useful, and it should be priyam. It should be pleasing. So it's not just, you don't have to say everything you feel or think, you know. But what you do say, because there's a whole bunch of things you can say. There's a whole bunch of things falling, going through your mind. Many of which are going to need your shama dhamma. Okay, so. But of the things that you decide to speak, they should be true, and they should be helpful, beneficial, and they should be pleasing. Unless you're the person's teacher, Unless you're the person's teacher or parent. You know, the parent, you have to sometimes, you know, you have to be a little strict sometimes, you know. And the teacher has to say how it is. It doesn't mean it has to be mean, but still, you know, it has to be real. But, you know, in most relationships, nobody's given you that right, really, to even to give advice, let alone to give it in a cranky or mean way. Nobody's gives permission for that, you know. And so you're going beyond your boundaries. It's not satyam, hitam, and priyam. Now, if you just think about your relationship with other people, especially just people who are kind of friends or people that you work with, you know, satyam, hitam, and priyam. And if you go outside of that, it's kind of not appropriate, you know, and people don't appreciate it, you know. And it keeps you very clean inside. So the satyam is important. One of the highest, it's probably the most valued. But this satyam ayatanam, this abode, can also be taken as Brahman, the paramarthika satyam. You take it both ways. Because of the value, satyam stands out by itself as the highest value. The octapas of satyam, hitam, priyam, never practice any kind of deceit. But also, it can go up in the other one where it says iti, that gives these three, and then it says iti, it can be included in those, in etc. Iti is etc. Of course, you are then including in the etc. actually the most predominant of all of the values, so it doesn't quite make sense, but nevertheless it could be there. And then we take satyam as the adhishtana, that the whole Vedas themselves rest in the adhishtana, the truth, the one from whom the whole creation has come, which also makes its beautiful sense, that this whole manifest creation from which the Vedas are considered to be beginningless has for its adhishtana, for its root, Brahman. So the Brahman, the adhishtana of the whole creation. So that's another beautiful thing. So this, with this verse here, this is a continuation of the last verse, which is saying this is the other rahasyam, the often not talked about rahasyam, secret, because this is what you need in order to be able to gain this knowledge. You need an antakarana. You need antakarana shuddhi. Antakarana shuddhi doesn't mean being a saint. It means having that the buddhi has the capacity to be kind to all. As I read with Swamiji in that last class, the buddhi has the capacity to be kind, to have viveka, to be kind internally and externally. If the buddhi has that ability, then the buddhi has antakarana shuddhi, and it has compassion and love and care for the things that come into its experience. Remember, the buddhi is the one that can differentiate all of your experiences. So the buddhi is the one that does the inner child work. The buddhi is the one that invokes the inner friend. Someone was asking, you know, I have had clients and people like this who, when I teach this inner friend stuff to them, well, I don't have an inner friend. That means we're looking around inside for an inner friend and we don't find anybody. But that's not how to think about the inner friend. We are friendly. We are friends to our friends, to our animals, to our plants, to our loved ones. You know what it is to be a friend. So you have to invoke that part of yourself that is a friend to your loved ones, or even to your animals or your plants. That one who is a friend to all of them, you have to turn as though inward toward yourself. Because that's what we don't do. It's not that you don't know how to be a friend. You don't know how to be, or may have never thought of how to be a friend to yourself. The one who gives you the benefit of the doubt, who knows that you're a good person, who knows that you're trying it, you're the best that you can, that gives the benefit of the doubt and tries to help rather than being critical, you know? Nobody likes a person who's critical of them. It's really unpleasant. Right. It's something you want to just kind of shrivel up and crawl away. You really don't, it's not very nice, right? But we can be so critical of ourselves. And that's because probably your parents were critical of you in one way or another, and you've just internalized that, and you're critical. Yeah? Usually you may be critical of other people, but you often don't say that because it's not appropriate, you know. But you can go on and on and on toward yourself. And so now, instead of that critical voice or that hurtful voice making a very unhappy home inside, you know, you find that part of yourself that is a friend to others. And then that one, that part of you, you turn toward yourself and toward your own mind and your own pains and hurts. And then that person, once that inner friend is dominant, you know, that attitude is dominant, the buddhi has that antakarana shuddhi, you know. And so the antakarana shuddhi is not as far away as you think. If you include all the complexes and hurts and pains that we have inside, then you'll think, oh my God. Yeah. But if you know how to have compassion and care for those little ones, then you have the antakarana shuddhi and you have the compassion and care for these little ones inside and these complexes inside, as well as for the people outside. That's the antakarana shuddhi. Your mind has room. That's so important. Anyway, the satyam we can take either way, as the adhisthana or as the self or as just satyam itself, speaking the truth. So let's do this last verse. This is the closing verse. It'll only take 10-15 minutes.
Yo vai etam evam, yo vai etam evam, veda pahatya, papmanam, papmanam, anante swarge loke, anante swarge loke, jaye, jaye, pratitishtati. Pratitishtati. Pratitishtati.
Pratitishtati. Yaha vai etam evam. Repeat.
Yaha vai etam.
Sorry. Yaha vai etam evam.
Yaha vai etam evam.
Veda apahatya.
Veda apahatya.
Papmanam.
Papmanam.
Anante.
Swarge,
loke,
jaye,
pratitishtati, pratitishtati, yaha vai etam evam veda. He who knows etam, this knowledge is taught in the Upanishads. Brahmavidyam, etam, brahmavidyam. He knows this knowledge of Brahman. Evam, in this manner, who knows the two rahasyas, you know, who knows the knowledge that's unfolded in the Upanishad, and knows about the antakarana shuddhi, how to gain the antakarana shuddhi. That's the second rahasyam, the recognition of that as a necessity, that the mind has to have a certain maturity in order to for this knowledge to be available. So the one who knows this brahmavidyam in this manner, Veda means knows, evam in this manner, it says, apahatya papmanam, having destroyed, because of that knowledge, and because of the antakarana shuddhi, having destroyed apahatyam all the papa, papmanam, having destroyed the papa. The papa really... Papa actually is both punya and papa is considered and papa at this level. So both punya and papa are considered papa because both of them require a karta, a doer, you know, and I gain this punya and papa to keep me transmigrating. Of course, I want to get better, bigger and better homes, bigger and better upadis, go to Swargaloka and all of these things, but I'm still stuck in samsara. I'm still stuck in the samsara chakra of birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. So really, the main papa, the papa that we're talking about, is the avidya, the self-ignorance, that causes us to do karma, causes us to have kama, desire, which causes us to do karma. So it's called avidya, kama, karma, this triputi, this group of three, is really the result of all of it, stems out of the ajnana, as does the antakarana. So the main, it's considered papa, and now the reason that they say papa, it's not, if we're talking about avidya, you haven't committed any papa, it's just that it causes pain. That's the papa. It's called a papa because the avidya itself causes pain. Why? Because it makes me, the one who's the adhishtana, the satchit ananda, the whole creation, absolutely free, absolutely whole and complete. That avidya, from the standpoint of the jiva, makes me into a limited being subject to birth and death with my ananda out there, and myself is like projected out there, and I have to go and try to get it. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Too many things have to line up. It has to be there, I have to be able to see it, I have to find a pathway to get it, and I have to continue wanting it the whole way. And then I can get it and I could think, God, now what am I going to do with this? You know, it becomes a garage sale item. Or it becomes, I married somebody who it's time to separate from, it was a mistake. You know, but it wasn't a mistake at the time. Of course, it probably was a mistake at the time. But not to me. Because of the ajnanam, you know, because of that ignorance, because that desire, you know, for whatever unconscious reason, landed on that person, you know, and then I ended up getting married. Happy for some time. And then completely devastated that I'm stuck in this relationship that is very painful to get out of. And this is kind of the worst case scenario. But this is a worst case, one of the worst case scenarios. There are lesser little scenarios, all in relationship to my desires. They're not binding, they're binding desires. That means if it doesn't work out the way I want to, I'm very unhappy. And so this avidya is, we can say the main papa is avidya, not that anything's been done to create that avidya, it's beginningless, but it's a great source of pain. And knowledge removes that avidya. And so in the removal of that avidya, I get myself back. I get back the self, the atma, my being that has always been there. It's never not been there. But because of the ajnanam, it's projected out onto the world, and then I'm running all around after it. The horrible problem is, I'm running after it, and it's not out there. Mm-hmm. So it never works. All that works is that when you get that thing that you projected the ananda on, for a minute your mind relaxes. It just relaxes. You have a shantavritti because you've gotten yourself back, you think. It's all just a grand, grand illusion. And sooner or later you figure that out, you become a mumuksha, you get a guru, and you get knowledge. So then it says, epahatya patmanam, having destroyed that all of that ignorance, so those who gained this brahmavidya, having known this brahmavidya, which has destroyed all of this papa, the whole cycle of papa, then what? Anante, limitless swargaloka, in this limitless swargaloka. This is interesting. Swargaloka is the highest you can go in samsara. And it will last, you'll stay there, with all of your desires being fulfilled as they come, you'll stay there to the end of the kalpa. And then you come back as a jiva and you kind of start all over. So the Swargaloka, where there's only really the experience of ananda there, is not ananta. It's the highest you can go, and it lasts for a long time, but it's not free of time. Right? And so it comes to an end. So here they say, the anante swarga loke, that ananta swarga loka, that's the highest, it's higher than the highest, it's jaya, if you see this, jaya means it's higher than the swarga loka. Why do they use swarga loka? Because everyone in the tradition, and within the Vedic tradition, knows that's the utmost. If I can just go to swarga loka, that's it, that's the highest I can go. Then he says, you gain the ananta swargaloka, which is jaya. Jaya means it's higher. It's more. It's better. You gain that swargaloka, which is the ananda. Swarga actually means sukha. That loka, that state, which is absolute sukha, ananda, you know, which is jaya, which is higher than the Swargaloka that you know about. And what does it mean you gain? What it says actually is pratishthati. You become established there. Because all of the ajnanam is gone, you become established in yourself. Right? For you, there's no more birth. You don't come back again as a jiva, because the jivatvam itself is a product of ajnanam. There is no jiva really. There's really only Ishvara. There's only Brahman and the manifestation of this creation. So you are Brahman. You are Ishvara. The jiva is a product of ignorance. There really is no jiva. There's no small little conscious being running around. There's only one Brahman, one Ishvara, and the jiva upadhi is just part and parcel of the Ishvara upadhi, like a cell in the body. So there is no more, once that ajnanam is removed, which is responsible for this kind of illusion, responsible for this projection, and this what we call anyonya, this mutual superimposition, that's no longer there. There's no, even while you're living, it's not there. And so there, while you're living, that jivatvam is not even there. Because you know yourself, and yourself is not a jiva, yourself is Brahman. It's not like you think you're Brahman, that Upanishad says you're Brahman. You have recognized the fact of it. You are Brahman. That's who this me is. So you see it. It's aparoksha jnanam, it's direct. There's no more ajnanam. So pratishthati, you are established in that. There's no coming back. So it says here, pratitishtati. They say that twice to say this is the end of the Upanishad. Om Tat Sat. Pratitishtati, pratitishtati. Om Tat Sat. If you chant the verse, apyayam tu.
Shrotramato Palamindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakarnam Astva Nirakarnam Ehastu Taratmani Nirate Upanishad Sudharmaste Mai Santu Te Mai Santu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Harihi Om
Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Such a blessing to feel and be able to do an Upanishad and finish it. You're going to do puja now? Who's doing it? Okay, beautiful. Yeah, let's gather the text.